Good morning, my brothers and sisters. How are you? In order to be part of and see happen all that God does through us, it requires us to give ourselves, give of our energies, to give our mind, to give our time, to give our resources. And so as the bag goes by, that's just one of the many ways that we give ourselves to the mission. So the ushers would come forward and provide that opportunity for us. If we came prepared to partner that way, that's what that is about. There's some people out in the field, and they could see there's a man coming, followed by a loose V of followers, hundreds, perhaps thousands of people behind him. And it was pretty easy to tell there in the Galilean hillside that that's Jesus. He's coming back through. Some of the kids that were in the crowd were running ahead and telling their family and telling other people that would listen, Jesus is coming back to town. And Jesus, he didn't have a whole lot of notoriety yet. He did have quite a group of people that followed him around, but he hadn't really begun to make waves yet, and hadn't really begun to get the following that he would have within the Jewish and then the extra Jewish context that he would. This was pretty early on, and so he's walking back through the Galilean hillside by this group of people that has really every conceivable background, at least in a Jewish context, represented. There are people who you would call the religious elite. They'd spent a lot of their life trying to figure out what the scriptures say. I mean, they knew it forward and backward by heart. They didn't even need to, many of them, have it in their hands anymore. They knew what it said inside and out, and they were able to apply it to government and to family and to what it meant to raising kids and raising crops and finances and all that. There were scribes who had given their life to meticulously writing down everything important people said. Then there were people who had woke up that morning and were surprised that that happened because of how the night before had gone. There were people who just, they live in the shadows. And then there are people who they try to do good, but they just, because of maybe a lack of education or lack of opportunity, just very disappointed with how life had gone. And then there were the sick, and then there were the angry, and then there were the hopeful, but only because they were stupid. And then everybody in between. And this whole crowd of people follows Jesus up this hillside. And Jesus goes and he finds a spot where there's a good stack of rocks, and he goes and he sits and he's able to look at all of these diverse faces. And people gather around in concentric circles. The people that assumed I deserved to be close sat up front. Then people are like, man, if anybody knew I was here, they'd throw me out. So they stay in the periphery. And all of these hundreds, perhaps thousands of people gather around. And it's not like Jesus hadn't spoken yet. But Jesus is getting ready to publicly speak. I mean, he already has a little bit of a reputation because he can do some things others can't do. He can heal where other people just kind of threw up their hands. And he's saying things that others just don't have the guts to say, or nobody ever even thought to say before. And they're all gathered, and Jesus, atop this rock, he takes a deep breath, it says in Matthew chapter 5, and it leaves a little bit of tension in the air, because in Matthew chapter 5 it says, and he opened his mouth and said, and Jesus begins his public ministry, what we would call an inaugural address, and what would become the Sermon on the Mount, one of the most influential speeches ever given in human history. And the first word that this Jesus says is Makarios. His ministry begins. His public ministry is now out there in the light for everybody to have access to it. He's looking at all these people, and the first word out of his mouth, Makarios. Now, there's been some debate and at least a lot of discussion on how do you translate this word. And for the most part, in the English language, it's been translated the same way over and over. Now, if you speak Spanish or German or French, you find that the word has a slightly different connotation. But as we look, when Jesus begins the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, verse 3, it's translated this way. Blessed are the poor, blessed are those who mourn, blessed are the meek, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, blessed are the merciful, blessed are the pure in heart, blessed are the peacemakers, blessed are those who are persecuted, blessed, blessed, blessed. This word, Makarios is translated blessed, and we're familiar with that. We're comfortable with that. But here there's a problem with it. If you felt like you were allowed to be honest, what in the world does blessed mean? Blessed are the poor in spirit. Yeah, blessed. I mean, it's one of those words you don't have to define. You're just blessed. Yeah, but what does that mean? Well, it's like there's this dust. And you spring, now you're blessed. What does it mean? I don't know, but look, I'm sparkly. What is the substance of being blessed? What does it mean? I know we're comfortable with it. We're familiar with it. But what in the world does the word mean? Bear in mind that the people in this crowd are suffering some of the worst government persecution there has ever been. The Jewish people, by way of their own religion, and then the government that keeps its foot on that religion, have their already paltry income taxed. Scholars think somewhere between 70% and 80%. When you get sick back then, there's no CVS. When you are having a child, it's kind of a coin toss if your wife will make it through. When you get sick for a number of days in a fever, sometimes the best you can afford or the best there is available is for somebody to come over and to maybe lay some palm fronds on you and put oil on your head. So now you have a headache and you're greasy. They don't have money. They don't have ease. They're not very comfortable. They're sick. Many of them, they're hopeless. They've given up. They're cynical. They're bitter. And some of those are hard to identify with. But understand, on the way to the Sermon on the Mount, hey, I heard that guru, that guy. Is it Jesus? Yeah, it's Jesus. On the way there, there were arguments. There were spats. People saw other people that as soon as they see each other, there's a tension that everybody feels. There were kid problems. There were, don't make me pull this donkey over. All of that was in place. So it's not just, well, first century woes. All the human difficulties are represented in this giant cluster of people. And what I want to explore today is that Jesus didn't just say, blessed, and everybody went, cool, what is he? The word is most easily and accurately translated, happy. What is Jesus' first word publicly? Happy. Happy are you. Happy are you. Happy are you. That sounds like Yoda. So his first word is happy. Makarios. And we guard against it because a lot of, especially the grown men in the room will be like, oh, so that's the goal, is to walk around with a goofy smile on your face in Christianity? Can we please take life more seriously? The only people that walk around smiling are, they're too naive to realize what's really going on. That's why they're smiling. If they were smarter, they would wipe the smile off their silly face. That's why translators struggle with this in the English language. Because happy is so thin. We're talking about something kind of superficial. Oftentimes when we say happy, but I'm not talking about that kind of happy. I mean, every time I say happy from here on, just assume I'm saying, if I don't, true happiness, contentment, fulfillment, that deep sense of whole peace inside of you. It's what every single human being in this room is after. It's why most of us are here. It's why most of us keep coming back here or somewhere else. I just need a taste, a glimpse, something that will remind me that happiness, the true stuff, is possible. It's what we all care about. Not the fleeting, wishy-washy, true happiness. Now, and some scholars will say, no, what you're talking about is joy, and happiness and joy are... No, don't. Well, let's not do that. I'm talking about, we know what we're talking about. True happiness. That fulfillment, that meaning, that peace, it's what we all want. Now, if somebody wants your attention, they're going to do really well to deal with your happiness. If somebody wants you to follow them, they're going to have to deal with what you want. And what you want has to do with fundamental core happiness. And so anybody that wants you to follow them has to deal with that. And they have to illuminate our unhappiness, our dissatisfactions, and then offer with their products or services a way out of that unhappiness. See, our unhappiness is always, always, always being reinforced. And if you point to any one example, you sound a little bit paranoid. But you have to understand, our whole culture runs on the assumption that you're unhappy. I used to be in advertising. I got to sell advertising. I got to write commercials. And guys, I've always been fascinated with the power of words and images. And some of the people I worked with, they taught me to be really critical of the messages that come across, you know, in billboards or TV or through the radio, all of that. And most of us, we're pretty savvy. We know what's going on for the most part, but we allow them to do it to us anyway. But I've become really sensitive in deconstructing the message that's latent underneath a lot of advertising. Just last week, age-defying makeup. I don't know if that's the brand name or just the genre that promises age defiance. And I've heard it a million times, but I didn't notice until this time that the commercial is 31 seconds long. And in 31 seconds, it connects age defiance with flaws for flawless beauty. And at the end, it used the word imperfection. Now, in half a minute, what's it doing? It's telling you, hey, there are signs that you're still alive, ladies. But that's nothing to celebrate. Those are flaws. Those are imperfections. You now need makeup, which is one of the ways we describe pretending. Now, on the flip side, what does this reinforce to men? Hey, see that gal over there? She's got some flaws, doesn't she? She's imperfect. Why? Because she's not young. The woman in this commercial, defying age, look, I mean, she could have been my daughter. Like, oh, yeah, you got one foot in the grave. Fight hard, young one. But she and her boyfriend or her husband are fighting something in this one particular column. Who wants to be flawed? I want to be flawless. Who wants to be imperfect? What man goes out saying, I'm looking for me tonight, an imperfect lady? None of us do that. And so, well, yeah, this it's makeup, Doherty. Let's not get too worked up. But in that college, see how comfortable we are with saying age-defying and flaw and imperfection. There was a chip commercial on. And not like the cool motorcycle cops, but chips, snacks. And this snack commercial, in half a minute, never once talked about flavor, the shape of their chip, nothing. It talked about change, changing the world. It assumes you don't like how things are, and you're a little hungry. In this bag is the secret to both. Like you and your buddy got a shopping cart, and you're getting some snacks for the Super Bowl, and he grabs regular potato chips. And you're like, whoa, friend. I snack with meaning. When the iPad first came out, I was an early adopter. This answers a lot of my needs where communicating is concerned. I'm one of the rare people that like these. When the iPad first came out, there's a bunch of people that snagged them. Well, there's a couple of groups of people that cracked me up. They buy things so that they can take them apart and show you what's in it. And so they took the iPad apart, and in the frame of the original iPad, there's a little socket at the top where a camera would fit. But as we know, the iPad 1 has no camera, but it already structurally is ready for one. Now, there's all kinds of economic reasons why that might be true, or software entanglements or whatever else. But you and I probably are sure why they did this. Because what happens when the iPad 2 came out with a camera in that socket? What happened in the minds and hearts of people like me who had the iPad 1? Get this piece of junk out of my face. What is this, an 8-track cassette? See, over and over and over, we're told, and again, you have to understand, this is an accumulative phenomenon. If you pick on any one thing, you sound paranoid. Over and over and over, we tell ourselves that we're not yet okay. Now, this isn't them telling us. There is no them. It's us telling us this, that just around the corner is true happiness. And then we all kind of grin, yeah, we know you can't buy happiness. But something drags us around the corner. And then something says, oh, you just missed it. It's around the corner. And we go, we spend our whole life running around a block. Makarios is just around the corner. We're constantly being convinced that we're not yet fulfilled or happy. And here's the thing. No one example, because there's no one piece of curriculum that tells the whole story. It's the sum total of all these different things going on. But here's the thing. You and I are constantly being programmed, and then that programming is getting updated into our heads, constantly being programmed that we should feel good about being drawn into neediness. We're very needy. We're needy with people. We're needy with stuff. We're needy with experiences. And we are absolutely convinced that we are unhappy. And so even though we know where happiness isn't, we continue to build and fund and fuel the machine that tells us this lie. We all know it's not true, but we all just refuse to live otherwise. It's like we're all caught in an 80s dress-up party, and we're all looking around going, this isn't real, and we're dancing to bad music, but nobody will leave. We absolutely, fundamentally know that the kind of happiness that we're being promised isn't actually happiness, and yet we continue to do this to ourselves because we believe that we are unhappy. Unhappy, unhappy. Our nation is rooted in and built upon human beings, each and every human being having the inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of. What does that assume? You don't have it. That happiness is something that you're going to have to be free to go get and keep. It's a core tenet to what it means to be an American. You have the freedom to go find what makes you happy and keep it. So long as it doesn't infringe upon somebody else's happiness. Foundational to who we are. So that's why we're convinced at our core that we're not happy. And we obsess ourselves with the pursuit of it. Because we're running on the assumption that we're just not yet happy. Oh man, Makarios, just around the corner. Keep going, keep pursuing, keep finding it. So the question is, when does Jesus start saving us? When does salvation begin in the Bible? A lot of people would say, yeah, it's when he dies on the cross, our sins are paid for, great. Or no, it's when he resurrects and then death is canceled out and he gives us life. Awesome, looking forward to living for a long time. My thoughts, which I'm going to share with you today, something I've been wrestling with a couple of years. And when I mean wrestling, I mean going through it with a lot of difficulty and really trying to get at the root of this. I'm going to share some of that today, some of the things that I have been learning. I think salvation begins when Jesus opens his mouth and says, happy. I think that's when it starts. That's when the message of salvation starts. It depends on what you think we're being rescued from. If you think it all has to do with after you die, you miss really on the core that it's about living. Salvation, being rescued, is about things that want to take your life right now, not just, well, what's going to happen post-mortem. The salvation message begins when he stands up in front of all these people and he understands all their context and all their excuses why they say, no, Jesus, not me. He says, no. Happy are these, present tense. Not happy will be if we can tweak and exchange and trade and spin and polish. No, right now, you're happy. It's already true. You are content now, though the circumstances all around you and banging around in your head would not justify that there's a lot of circumstances that aren't yet in place. Nobody else is going to really understand it. But happy are you. Over and over and over and over in the scriptures, we are warned not to try to find fulfillment in life by chasing our desires any which way they lead us. Over and over, if it has to do with money, it has to do with sexuality, it has to do with how we do relationships, how we stand on each other, our acquisitiveness, or that which we acquire or try to achieve, no matter who gets in our way or who we have to step on to do it. Over and over and over, we're warned. I know it looks like just a little bit of hunger and an apple. Don't believe it. You already have what you need, but the apple looks good and it's good for wisdom and it's really shiny. Don't believe, over and over from one end of the Bible to the other, don't let your desires make you think that you're nothing but the sum total of your superficialities. Don't buy it. Don't buy it. Don't buy it. You already have everything that you need in that you were made in the image of the great God of the universe, and that he loves you. What more could you possibly need? Oh, I know. We talked about it on Sunday. Over and over and over. So Paul talks about this because Paul knew more than any of us will ever know about the scriptures. He could do it from memory. He was willing to kill people who got it wrong. So he was a persecutor when his name was Saul. He persecuted those that tried to give themselves to Jesus or tried to say that this Jesus was the Messiah. And then suddenly he has this exchange with Jesus, the resurrected Christ, and he finds his head on backwards and all of his philosophies and theologies and everything kind of upended. And now he becomes kind of the leading voice in the area for Jesus being the Christ the Jews were waiting for. So he goes to town to town to town, and he always starts with the synagogue because they already know their Bibles, and he gets frustrated oftentimes. And he says, okay, enough with that. And then he goes to the Gentiles, non-Jews, who've never seen a Bible, and he talks to them very differently about it. But it's the same pattern over and over and over and over. And one of the parts of that pattern is he keeps getting thrown in jail. Which I find very unattractive. Like, if you're doing something and every time you visit a town, you get to know intimately for months or even years their prison, I'd find another career. But he continues to do this. And so in Philippi, he finds himself imprisoned. And after a while, he starts to think, oh, okay, I think I've been forgotten by my brothers and sisters. That I haven't heard from anybody in a while. You don't eat unless your friends bring you food in this circumstance. There's no TV. You know, it's not like our current jail facilities. These you're lowered into, and the only light that gets in comes through the cracks in the wall. But Paul says something absolutely transformative to me. I hope you can get some of the excitement out of how I feel about this into your own heads, because I think that this is such a foundational key thing to living the best life possible that Jesus invites us into. He says this toward the end of his letter to the Philippians: rejoice in the Lord always. I'll say it again, rejoice. Celebrate. Now, if somebody is like, if they're saying that from their Bentley, you kind of roll your eyes. When you get a letter from prison and it says, celebrate the Lord always, I'll say it again, rejoice, you're like, holy cow, this guy's either nuts or I am. Rejoice in the Lord always. I'll say it again. Rejoice, celebrate. Let your gentleness be evident to all. Don't live aggressively. The Lord is near. Don't be anxious about anything, but in every situation, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. Stop putting your requests on people. Don't do that to people. Give your requests to God. Don't live so anxiously. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, which means it goes beyond what you're going to be able to understand even for yourself, let alone other people, will guard, protect your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Finally, and he's winding down the letter, brothers and sisters, whatever's true, whatever's noble, whatever's right, whatever's pure, whatever's lovely or admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, obsess about those things. Isn't that a helpful thing for Paul to say? I'm not offended, but while I've been talking, you all have already started your Monday office time. While I'm talking, all you can think about is, did I leave the iron on and are my kids going to turn out okay? Obsessed with worst case scenarios, living anxiously. And Paul says, look, from a prison cell, I'm telling you, don't fixate on those things. Don't do that. Don't be a slave to all the worst case scenarios that you can come up with. Whatever you have learned or received or heard from me or seen in me, put it into practice. And the God of peace will be with you. Now, here's where this is mind-blowing. Verse 10. I rejoiced greatly in the Lord that at last you renewed your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned, but you had no opportunity to show it. In other words, I kind of thought this prison cell was going to end up being my tomb. I hadn't heard from anybody in a while, and I get really bad reception in this cell. There's a lot more time going between meals. I really just kind of felt like, okay, this is it. They got too busy. But indeed, you were concerned. You just didn't have an opportunity to show it. Oh, maybe there's red tape and getting through the prison guards or getting the food or whatever it was. But then here, he says, I'm not saying this because I'm needy. Because I've learned to be content whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need. And I know what it is to have plenty. I've learned the secret, the mysterion, the mystery of being content in any and every situation, whether I'm well fed or I'm hungry, living in plenty or want or anything in between. I can do all of this through him that gives me strength. I was starting to think maybe you guys forgot about me. I was hoping you were going to come. I rejoiced greatly. Yes, they came. I prefer eating versus starvation. But I'm not telling you like something at my center was feeling under threat. I'm good either way. He finishes up this section with saying, I can do all this or all things through Christ or through him that gives me strength. What is this strength? Does Jesus come in and do it for you? Are we back to the Christ blessing dust? Is that what we're talking about? Because what he says is, I can do all this through the strength that I'm getting through Christ. So it's not just a religious veneer. Oh, I pretend to like things I don't like now, so you'll all think I'm hyper-religious. No, no, no. I'm actually receiving strength by what Jesus, the mysteries that Jesus reveals to me. And it's me doing it. He's teaching, I get to do. And the net result is it doesn't matter what the circumstances are. As evidenced by, I'm writing this to you from a prison cell. I'm good. I prefer to eat over not eating. I don't pretend to like things I don't like, but I'm happy. This is an amazing couple of words right here where it says, I've learned to be content. Being content in any and every situation. Content can just kind of be, for some of us, not all of us, but for some of us, we hear content, we think it's just kind of resigned. Like, you know what, I give up. I'll just be happy with this. But the word is very interesting in Greek. It breaks down this way. It's, go to the next slide. Autarkes. It breaks down auto, the first part, means self. Archeo, the root word of the second part, sufficiency or enough. Now, he's not saying I gave up on humanity and it's all up to me. If it's going to be, it's up to me. I created my own religion. Everybody else stinks and I don't. No, what he's saying is I'm learning how to be a whole person. That what Christ actually gives you is oftentimes not a change in circumstances, and he certainly won't change other people's behaviors to suit you. He teaches you and awakens the inside of you so that you will learn the mystery, the secret of happiness being present regardless of all that other stuff. That's why he keeps talking about celebration and peace and contentment. He'd learned it. He'd learned the mystery of contentment regardless of external factors. So here is where I think we're talking right now about salvation. We're talking about being rescued from something. And so with the sensitivities of all the things that are going on in this, some of you got the worst news of your life this week. I don't know. Some of you, you're puzzled. Some of you, you're clinically depressed, or you're grieving. All of that stuff is true. All of that stuff is actually going on. But here's what I think. Here's what I think is at the core of the good news that Jesus is inviting us into. Something that we can have in him. And I'm going to say this sentence, and I want to tell you, it's not 100% resolved in my head. And I'm going to say this sentence, and you're going to want to argue. I pray that you wait until I'm done. You're going to see it, and a lot of you will immediately disagree with it, and some of you will go, that works in here or philosophically, but as soon as that door cracks, it's over. But I really do believe this, and I pray that you'll wrestle through it with me. And here's the phrase. True happiness has no cause. Pause for dramatic effect. Happiness has no cause. It's uncaused. Now, excitement, pleasure, experiences, those things are all great. I've come to learn I enjoy pleasure. I don't know about you. I like pleasurable things. That's not happiness. I like the thrill of a roller coaster. But if I get off and then I notice, well, now my mood's down in the dumps again. Okay, so what I was experiencing wasn't true happiness. That was a thrill, and I like it. And many of us, we're on roller coasters for 8, 9, 10 years, burying the fact that we don't understand the source of actual happiness. And so we think the thrill ride is the contentment. We'll fool ourselves for years. But that's not what we're talking about, is it? No, that's thrills and pleasures and certain experiences. That's not happiness. Happiness is already true. You already have it. It's already true. Underneath our frustrations, our bitterness, our anger, our disappointment, our grieving, our grievances, underneath all of that lies our happiness that we've always had, a contentment. It's already there, and we spend much of our life going out there trying to get it out of different circumstances and out of people. But listen, if happiness has a cause, we're in deep trouble, because that means it's not up to us. It's up to other people in other circumstances. We don't get to choose. Instead, we live our lives anxiously trying to manipulate meaning and fulfillment and satisfaction out of others. But you can't let them see that, because that's creepy. And so you have to spend your life trying to figure out how to get a sense of happiness and contentment out of other people, or wringing it out of circumstances, or trying to find other circumstances you can get it out of. It's not up to you. You see how troublesome that is? How anxious you would be? But we're so used to thinking about that this is how it works. I mean, listen to the way, and I've become really sensitive to this, listen to the way that we talk about people. Like, let me stand up real quick. All right. Mustache. Stand up real quick. All right, you stay right there. You see this guy? He makes me so angry. How about you?
No.
Now, this guy, great mustache, by the way. Is it Movember, or is this always you? Always. Okay. Nicely done. This, if you don't know what Movember is, that's just awkward. I said, I don't like this guy. He makes me mad. This guy says, oh, he doesn't bother me. So what does that tell us? He's not really making me mad, is he? I am getting upset about him. If he could make me mad, how come he's not making him mad? He doesn't have any power over my mad, does he? It's me. I love you in Jesus' name. I really do. Thank you very much. What's your name?
Pete.
I think you're awesome. You're named after an apostle. I mean, it's really, it's great. You're all right, dude. You ever notice she makes me sick. They frustrate me, and he makes me so mad. We believe other people control our moods. It's not true, because if Pete actually was controlling whether or not, if he was really making me angry, how come he isn't making the rest of us angry? Because it's my choice, isn't it? We're so used to believing that other people have power over our insides that we've stopped asking questions about what's really going on. And we think that our happiness is somewhere outside of us. And Paul, from a prison cell, goes, I've got really great news, this deep mystery, that Jesus is awakening me to all the ways that none of that was ever true. That I have learned how to be self-contained and whole in any circumstances. I'm happy. I'm good. I don't pretend to like things I don't like. I would much prefer eating to not eating. But I'm happy. I'm actually happy. I don't quote bumper stickers a lot. But I saw one the other day that said, happiness is an inside job. This is what Jesus is trying to tell us. Makarios, are you now? No, Jesus, you don't understand. No, I do. I walk on water. I know things. Happy now. And begins the message of salvation for all of us. There's three lies I want you to entertain disbelieving with me. And they're simply this. My happiness is in someone else's hands. In order for me to be content and happy and fulfilled, you've got to give it to me. And I'm not happy because they withheld it. You apply it to your parents, your boss, a rebellious sibling, whatever. What if this is a lie, that your happiness is in somebody else's hands? Or a second one. My happiness is in some other circumstances. Well, of course you're happy. You've got X, Y, and Z. If I had that, I would be happy. But I've got this, and I can't be happy until I've got that. It's a lie. How often do we get what we were after when we find out, oh, they were unhappy too? Actually, I was happier before I had. Here's a third lie I hope that you'll consider disbelieving. That my happiness is in the future. Someday I'll be happy. If I can just get out of this season, if I can just get past this period of time where child rearing is concerned, if I can just get through this job, if I could just someday, it's a lie. And I'm young. 36 years old. I've not had huge catastrophes in my life, so I'm just going to put it all on Paul. Paul from a prison cell said, I'm good. I'm good. I'm happy. Do I want out? Yeah. Yep. I'd much prefer not to be in here. But I'm good. I'm happy. Over and over and over, I see people get back from the third world and they're shocked. But they're not so much shocked about the living conditions. These people are so happy. I want to go back. The community and the openness and the happiness and the peace. How can they be happy? Their kids play with bones for toys. And they come back and they have contempt for America. And then 3 months later, it goes away and they go right back to their 80s party. Over and over, we see, oh, wow, there's a whole other way to live. And sometimes we've got to disbelieve that happiness is something you put on as a facade. But it's actually found by tearing down and discovering that it's already there. What if happiness isn't something that we add, but something that we discover? Now, again, many of us are like, you don't understand. I'm chronically unhappy. I have chemical imbalances. I am depressed. Not just sad. I am depressed. I'm sensitive to all of that. I understand it. Some of us have more work to do than others. Our own physiology, our own upbringing fights against our ability to believe that maybe we have happiness already. I understand that. But watch in your own heart as I'm speaking. Are you defending your right to be unhappy? I can't be happy because of this, 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 this. I'm sensitive to that. But do you find yourself saying, no, I cannot be happy. Don't ever tell me I can be happy. Are you fighting for that? Ask that question of yourself. What if what has you unhappy doesn't come from outside of you, but a gross error and understanding where it actually comes from? This, I believe, Jesus was teaching Paul. Paul taught so many others. This, I believe, Jesus was teaching people who'd be persecuted and would die, would be killed. But Jesus, like he often doesn't, he didn't change their circumstances. He revealed to them a mystery that was true within their current circumstances. They died happy. I believe that's what he's teaching us. Not to give up on people, but to unattach ourselves from people because we find I'm not going to get that contentment and happiness out of people or other circumstances. I already have it. Therefore, I don't have to live manipulatively. It's already true. Now I'm free to love because now I'm not trying to get things from people. Now I'm free to give it. When you're fighting, are you running on the assumption your happiness is at stake? Do you believe your happiness is under attack? When you're arguing, do you believe your happiness is attackable? Or are you clear that there's a difference between being right and being happy? When you're making a purchase or you're longing to purchase something, are you crystal clear that you can't purchase happiness? I know you know the phrase, but are you crystal clear on the reality of that phrase? That actual happiness cannot be purchased or traded for. When you eat too much or you intoxify yourself, are you experiencing happiness or are you experiencing the burial of happiness? And do you know the difference? When you dwell on a relationship not going the way that you wanted it to go, are you clear on the difference? Because while it would have been great if that relationship would have worked out, were you quietly believing that this person was the key to your happiness and they took it from you and now you can't be happy? Did you put that on them? Did you enslave yourself to them accidentally? Are you clear that, no, I really would have liked that, but my happiness is mine. I'm good. When you bemoan your job, do you entertain that Jesus might be trying to teach you the mystery of contentment even there? When you dislike your job or when you dislike your joblessness, are you clear that you can dislike something and still be happy? Did you know that's possible? What if Jesus is saving us from the pursuit of happiness? Because somebody that loves us, the last thing he'd want to do is watch us chase something that's already ours. To live anxiously, defensively. What if he's freeing us from the freedom to pursue happiness? What if he loves us that much? A man had a dream that the next day he was going to wake up and find a great teacher. And when he asked him, that great teacher was going to give him great riches. And he bounced up awake and he was impressed with how realistic the dream was. So he washed his face and immediately went into the village. And not long after waking up that morning, he saw a man speaking and people kind of in a horseshoe shape around him listening. He was obviously the teacher. And so he went up and said, "Teacher, strange as this is, I had a dream that if I ask you for great riches, you would give them to me." And the teacher got a big smile on his face and said, "Wow, did your dream tell you what the riches were?" And he said, "No, but perhaps it's in your gunny sack." And so the teacher opens the sack and he rifles through and he pulls out a gemstone from the bottom and brushes it off. And this thing's the size of a walnut, a gemstone the likes of which nobody had ever seen, an enormously expensive, valuable gemstone. And the teacher, looking at it, still with the same smile, said, "Is it perhaps this?" And the man said, "Well, yeah. May I have it?" And the teacher said, "Of course, it's yours. Take it." And he was just so stunned at how all that had happened. He took the stone and he walked to the edge of town and he sat under a tree and just stared at it, realizing he was now worth millions. So he thought, okay, at one point I'm going to sell this, but what container would be worth using for a gemstone this nice? I mean, what do I keep this in until I sell it? Wait a minute. When I sell it, how do I know I'm getting everything I could get for it? And here he is sitting under this tree, as happy as he's ever been. But he notices he starts asking questions. How am I going to get the proper amount of money for this? And what will I buy? And how much will I save? And how will I find an honest person? And then he started thinking about, well, who do I let in on this? And who should I keep out of this? And suddenly he noticed his happiness was giving way to an anxiety, a worry, a whole other set of thoughts he hadn't had before. And so he stood up and the stone felt heavy in his hand and he put it in his pocket and he felt his shoulders slumped over and he went and walked slowly back into town. And there was the great teacher still mingling and speaking, the big smile on his face. And he just looked like peace. He just, even though he was now without the $1 million gem, he just looked at peace. And the man looked down at the gemstone and back at the teacher and realized he had yet to get from the teacher the great riches of which he dreamed. We'll see you next week.